Harvey Weinstein gets a shot at a new trial as New York's highest court overturns his 2020 conviction for sex crimes. Plus, a mistrial is declared in the case of the 75-year-old Arizona rancher charged with murder. And a jury has finally been picked in the highly anticipated trial of Boston woman Karen Reed. All this and more this week on Courtroom Confidential. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter, a former Los Angeles prosecutor turned criminal defense attorney with over 15 years' experience navigating the criminal justice system, bringing you my unique insights from both sides of the courtroom. Join us every Friday as we dive into headline-making cases from across the country. All right, let's jump right in. In a stunning reversal, New York's Court of Appeals handed down a decision on Thursday overturning Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction for sex crimes. The powerful Hollywood mogul whose downfall stood as a symbol of the Me Too movement. In a 4-3 decision, the court found that the judge who presided over Weinstein's trial had made critical errors on two major issues. First, in allowing the testimony of 4 women who testified to encounters with Weinstein that were unrelated to the charged crimes. And second, the judge's decision to permit prosecutors to question Weinstein about uncharged allegations spanning back decades if he decided to testify. The court reasoned, and this is a quote, "It is an abuse of discretion to permit untested allegations of nothing more than bad behavior that destroys a defendant's character but sheds no light on their credibility as related to the criminal charges." The court concluded that the overall effect of these erroneous rulings, quote, "destroyed even the semblance of a fair trial." A statement issued by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office said, "We will do everything in our power to retry this case and remain steadfast in our commitment to survivors of sexual assault." Weinstein had been sentenced to 23 years in prison for his conviction in the New York case. And remember, he was also convicted for similar yet unrelated crimes in Los Angeles last year, to which he was sentenced to 16 years. We will keep you posted on all these developments moving forward. But in the meantime, what is happening here? Why did this happen? Many people are reacting to this with shock, thinking it's a crooked system. This is what you get when you've got a bunch of money. You can buy your way out of anything. But really what this comes down to is an issue that, had you been watching closely and following this from a legal perspective, you're not really surprised. This comes down to the issue of prior bad acts. What are those? In certain cases, in certain instances, you are allowed to bring in uncharged prior crimes, uncharged prior bad acts, they're referred to, from other alleged victims, from other people who may not even be related to a charged crime, but can speak to different types of evidence. But what you can't speak to, and this is what this whole ruling hinges upon, what those people cannot testify to is simply character evidence. We have a long-standing belief in this country that when a criminal defendant is put on trial, they are to stand trial based upon the merits of the criminal allegations against them. Can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed a certain crime on a certain date? What you cannot do is put a person on trial for simply being a bad person. And that all flows into the idea of propensity. Are you putting on evidence of prior bad acts of a person, in this case, Harvey Weinstein, to say that he had a propensity to commit the crimes that he was charged with? So just so we understand, he was charged in the New York case with 2 separate victims for sexual assault. In that same case, though, however, the New York prosecutors and the judge allowed for the testimony of 4 other women who were not part of the charged case, not part of the crimes that were charged in that case. And those women testified to certain things that took place. And the judge allowed that in under certain exceptions. What the appellate court, though, is saying here is that those exceptions did not apply, and instead, all you were left with was this idea of propensity. It looks like he did this several times in the past. Therefore, he's the type of person to commit these types of crimes now. Therefore, he did commit these crimes. That is the mental steps and leaps that a jury is going to make and what we're concerned with and what we don't want them to make. Now, there are instances where character type evidence can be allowed to prove certain things like motive or opportunity or identity or a common scheme or plan. But you get into a real difficult area when you're asking jurors to split a very fine hair and say, we don't want you to listen to this evidence and say, well, it sounds like he may have done it in the past, and therefore we believe he did it now because he's got a propensity to do it. But instead, we want you to accept this evidence as merely showing that he had a motive, or that the identity of this person is the same, or these other reasons. And it's so nuanced and so difficult that sometimes lawyers, judges have a problem with it. Why wouldn't the jury have a problem with it? And in this case, the court said the judge in the trial court, by allowing that, went too far. And furthermore, because you were going to allow the prosecution to get into cross-examination on even further attenuated events of bad conduct that took place perhaps even decades before these allegations, if he were to testify, that essentially prevented him from testifying at all, and therefore he didn't get a fair trial. And it's important, I think, to understand that what this really stands for is the idea that getting a conviction at any cost is not the name of the game. That is not a prosecutor's job, but more importantly, it's not a judge's job. It's about doing these things the right way, because you don't want to have this happen. You want convictions to stand. You don't want them to be overturned over something like this. Many people are upset. Many people are mad. Many people are saying it's a corrupt system. But if you want to get mad at anyone, if you want to direct your ire towards anyone, it should be towards that trial judge. Because had the judge made the correct decisions in the first place and not allowed this evidence in, you very well could have seen a conviction against Harvey Weinstein that would have held up under scrutiny on appeal. But instead, now you've got this problem, and it's a big enough problem that the appellate court says there's no remedy but a new trial. Send this back to the trial court and give this man a new trial. And now the DA is in the position of having to call in all of these prior witnesses, all of these prior victims, have them go through all of that again, the crucible of cross-examination and all of the stress and uncomfortable feelings that they're going to have to go through to bring this trial to court again. And there's also the Los Angeles case to think about. Even if he wins this, even if it gets a new trial, even if he's acquitted at a new trial, he's still been sentenced to 16 years in prison in Los Angeles. Now, his team in Los Angeles is making the same appeal based on these same arguments, but the law in California is a little bit different, and it's far more favorable towards this type of evidence under Evidence Code 1108. And I don't think you'll have as good a chance, but still, you're losing out on 23 years that this man was convicted and perhaps putting these people through all of that trauma once again. All right, moving on. A jury deadlocked on Tuesday in the contentious trial of 75-year-old Arizona rancher George Allen Kelly. After over two full days of deliberations and receiving a, quote, dynamite charge from the judge, jurors could not come to a unanimous decision and a mistrial was declared in that case. If you'd like to learn more about this dynamite charge, I did a short video on it and we'll give you the link in the notes. Kelly faced second-degree murder charges in connection with the death of a Mexican citizen whose body was discovered over 100 yards from Kelly's ranch. Throughout the trial, Kelly's defense maintained that he fired warning shots over the heads of two men crossing his land. Investigators, however, testified to inconsistencies in Kelly's story, saying it wasn't until a half hour into questioning that Kelly admitted to firing his AK-47 assault rifle. Kelly opted not to testify in his own defense. It will now be up to the Santa Cruz County Attorney's Office to decide if Kelly will face a new trial in the case. A status hearing is set for next Monday afternoon. What's happening here? What does this case teach us? I think it teaches us a lot about how important criminal intent is, and that it is much more than just an element of the crime. it's important beyond just proving what a person was intending to do to the jurors. It means something to the jury to know what the defendant was thinking and what the defendant was feeling, because it's natural, I think, for jurors to place themselves in the position of the defendant. And if they understand what that person was thinking and what that person was feeling and the emotions that were going through their head at the time and what they then intended by their actions, it's not just a matter of proving that element, it's putting them in that position. And when you do, in a case like this, I think it becomes very difficult for the prosecution because they now have an understanding of perhaps the fear this man was experiencing, of how he was only trying to chase people off of his property, of how he was not intending to actually harm anyone. And I get it. I understand these people were over 100 yards away, over a football field away. I understand that. And warning shots are usually fired up in the air, folks, and they're not fired over somebody's head. I understand all of that. But being able to appreciate, and the defense did a good job of helping the jurors to understand and appreciate what was going through this man's mind, obviously caused issues in this case. Not to mention, too, that there was no forensic or ballistic evidence linking the actual bullet, which was never recovered, that took this man's life to the weapon that Kelly allegedly fired. So, again, if you want to talk about reasonable doubt, that's, I think, arguably enough right there. You cannot link this man to the fatal bullet. Is there a possible other explanation for what took this man's life? Yes. Are they reasonable? That's to be argued. But if that's enough for jurors to say, well, I don't know, and if they're starting to say, I don't know, then that's reasonable doubt, and that's where you're going to have problems for the prosecution. It's a case that I wonder what the prosecution would do differently if they bring this on a retrial. That's always a question to ask. What are you going to do differently? What witnesses did you not call the first time around that maybe you're going to call this time around? And will that actually affect the outcome? If you just plan on doing an absolute rewind of the last trial, then why would you expect any different results unless you feel that somehow you fundamentally had a huge problem in the way that you selected that jury? Again, we will watch this case. I'm curious to hear all your thoughts, though. I know you're going to have a lot to share about this, and I want to know, do you think this is a case that should just let it stand where it is? Should the prosecution give it another try? Let us know in the comments. All right. After nearly five full days, jury selection for the trial of Boston woman Karen Reed concluded on Wednesday. From a pool of 401 candidates, 19 jurors have been selected, with plans to trim that down to 12 regular jurors and 4 alternates. Reed faces murder charges in connection with the 2022 death of her boyfriend, police officer John O'Keefe. For a recap of this case, you can check out the Five Things episode I did on this channel, where we break down everything that I feel is important for you to know and understand before opening statements, which are scheduled to begin on Monday. Meanwhile, a hearing on several key motions took place on Thursday, including moving the trial to another courtroom to address defense concerns regarding the jury box configuration creating visibility issues for the jurors. The new courtroom is significantly smaller, allowing room only for media and family members of the victim and defendant. Judge Cannoni also ruled that prosecutors will be allowed to play audio but not video of Reed at the police station soon after her arrest, where she tells a booking officer, quote, "We're all in on the same joke, right?" Cannoni dealt another blow to the defense, ruling that Reed's attorneys may not tell jurors about a federal investigation into law enforcement's handling of the case and cannot mention in opening statements that the lead investigator in the case is the subject of an internal affairs review. Opening statements are expected to begin on Monday, and stay tuned, folks. We plan on doing a live reaction to all of it, so you won't miss a thing. Make sure and subscribe to this channel so that you'll be able to see that special episode. With 87 potential prosecution witnesses and 77 listed for the defense, trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. We will see if that actually takes place. All right, well, what's happening here? We talked a lot about this in past episodes, But all of the controversy surrounding this case, all of the circus, all of the conspiracy theories, all that you're hearing everyone talk about on the internet, much of that may not see the light of day in this case. Much of that may not be presented in court at all. What many people are expecting to play out in court, I think they are in for a rude awakening as to what actually is presented in court. Things like third-party culprit evidence. We've already heard rulings on this from the judge saying, you can't talk about it until I feel that you've properly laid a basis for this. And right now, I don't think that you have. That's a huge part of the defense case and a huge part of everything that we've been hearing about leading up to this trial. The federal investigations. How much have we heard about that? How much theories are floating around on the internet. And listen, before the mob comes for me, I'm not trying to say that there's no validity in any of that. I'm just saying that the judge has decided it's not relevant to the trial and is not going to allow a lot of that in, unless, of course, somehow the prosecution missteps and opens the door to it. Pay attention to the questioning from the prosecutors. If they start asking officers things like, and you had no reason to suspect otherwise, correct? That to me starts to open up doors. Oh, really? You had no reason to suspect otherwise? Well, isn't it true that you saw injuries that seemed to be consistent with a dog bite? And didn't you in fact realize that people inside the home had a motive or a reason that they might have wanted to? All of this, on and on and on and on, opens the door with even the slightest misstep by the prosecution. So they're going to need to be careful if they want to keep their case clean, as they've done a good job of getting some rulings out of the judge ahead of time. And this really drives home the point that how trials are really a living, breathing thing. They can turn on a dime. I've done many trials in my career, and I will tell you that you have an idea, and it's usually a very good idea of how this is all going to play out, but you have kind of a game plan going in as to what you expect the evidence will be, how witnesses will testify, how this will all play out. But boy, do things always take turns. It's not the Perry Mason type moments, but it's significant moments, and you have to be able to pivot and you have to be able to react. And some of these things that we're getting rulings on may not turn out to be exactly what plays out in court. So stay tuned to this channel. We will be covering it on nearly a daily basis, giving you live reactions, giving you commentary. It's going to be a fascinating trial. Please stay tuned. Before we jump into the other cases making headlines this week, I have some exciting news to share with you all. You may have heard the Courtroom Confidential is now also a podcast. So please check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave a review, share it with your friends. We appreciate all of your feedback. We appreciate this growing community that we are creating together. So we want to hear from you, and we want you to be able to follow us as a podcast as well. All right, also making headlines. After a temporary pause, the judge in the case of Brian Koberger, accused of killing four University of Idaho students in the fall of 2022, is allowing surveys with potential jurors to continue without modification. Prosecutors had challenged the surveys, arguing that they violated a broad gag order issued in the case. In other news, Koberger's lawyers revealed that they intend to use cell phone tower data to establish an alibi, saying, get this, that their client was out looking at the moon and stars at the time of the murders. Koberger faces four murder charges for the stabbing deaths of four college students. Prosecutors have stated that they intend to seek the death penalty if Koberger is convicted. The next hearing in this case is set for late June. Doomsday prophet Chad Daybell's triple murder trial continues in Idaho. Daybell is charged in the murder of his first wife, Tammy Daybell, and the two youngest children of his second wife, Lori Vallow. On Monday, the court heard testimony from several witnesses, including Lori Vallow's son, Colby Ryan. Ryan's testimony was emotional, with his voice breaking while trying to identify a picture of his sister, Tylee Ryan, one of the victims in this case. And Tuesday was the first day Chad Daybell was visibly emotional in court as well, as witnesses' testimony and images showed Tammy Daybell's dead body. Chad appeared to be crying upon the graphic testimony regarding Tammy's body. The trial is expected to last another 4 to 6 weeks. 81-year-old Ohio man William J. Brock fatally shot an Uber driver because he assumed she was part of a scheme to collect $12,000 in supposed bond money for a relative. The Uber driver, Lolitha Hall, was a victim of the same con, summoned by the scammer to Brock's house to retrieve a package for delivery. In police body cam video released last week, Brock appeared dazed and confused when police arrived at the scene. He is now facing charges of murder, assault, and kidnapping. Uber is helping investigators to try to catch whoever tried to pull off this scam. Before we get into what's on the docket for next week, I wanted to take this time to thank you all for your support. The love from our growing community has been amazing. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, please subscribe, please comment, and share with your friends. We always love to hear your feedback. On the docket next week, Brian Walsh, the Massachusetts man accused of killing his wife, Anna, dismembering her body with a hacksaw, and discarding her remains at trash transfer stations, is due back in court for his murder case on May 1st. Walsh's arrest made headlines last year when it was revealed that he conducted Google searches for things such as, quote, 10 ways to dispose of a dead body if you really need to, and, quote, can you be charged with murder without a body, within days of his wife's disappearance. The Arizona woman who accused a former major league pitcher, Trevor Bauer, of sexual assault has been criminally charged with defrauding the baseball player. While the indictment doesn't provide specific details about the alleged crimes, it says Bauer and one other person were defrauded in a scheme that potentially spanned several years. She is scheduled to be arraigned on the criminal charges today, April 26th. That's it for us. Once again, I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. You can find me on social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. Thank you again for joining me. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you all again next week.